Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here in my basement. Just had a great conversation with Janie Haddad Tompkins. Janie is wonderful. I met her at Max FunCon a few years ago. She is married to Paul F. Tompkins, and Paul was there doing his comedy thing with Super Ego, and Janie tagged along because Max FunCon is just a fun place to go, and met her poolside with Hodgman. And Janie was just sort of a kindred spirit, I feel like. She's also from the South and kind of reminded me of my wife, Emily, a little bit. I think they would be fast friends if they ever got to hang out. And just a lot of fun. Janie's super sweet and very funny, and she's an actor. And we get to talk about her auditioning for roles and this play that she did in Edinburgh and sort of working as a working actor and what that's like to go out and audition and to hang your hopes on something like that. And it was a lot of good insight. So we talk about that. We talk about Charleston, which is where she grew up and where sort of in the neighborhood of where the movie The Big Chill was set. And that was her pick, the 1983 dramedy from Lawrence Kasdan with just the bonkers cast. And we had a really great discussion about it. So here we go with Janie Haddad Tompkins on The Big Chill. Oh, look at you, handheld.
Well, that's fun.
Wow, that surprised me.
That's so fun.
Where are you? What room are you in?
We call this the guest room.
Okay, because guests stay there?
They can, yeah, if we take this couch and turn it into a bed.
Now, is that where Hodgman stayed when he lived with you guys for a period?
Oh, yes. He would probably call it his room, but it's really the guest
room. I'm sure he would.
The guest room, but it's also kind of like a den, you know.
Well, like your fish art.
Thank you. Thanks.
Very nice.
And where are you?
I'm in my basement. I have an old man band, and so I have a band room, and so I had all this sound paneling and stuff anyway, and I reconfigured it once the world ended, so I could still work.
Right.
How you guys?
And I hope the name of your band is Old Man Band.
Well, that's what all our wives call it. We named ourselves, but they don't have enough respect to refer to us as our real name.
That's really funny.
I was going to ask how you're doing, and I do want you to say that for the benefit of the listeners, but I've been listening to Stay F. Homekins, the podcast
you do
with your husband, Paul F. Tompkins, and it is so fun and funny, and I kind of feel like I know how you guys are doing.
Wow. Thanks. Thanks for listening. I mean, a lot of times on the podcast, we try not to allow our despair to come out, but
I think you do a good job. I mean, it's really funny.
We try.
And fun. And you guys are both so endearing and fun. And it's just, I'm glad that you're doing the show together. It's nice.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. At one time, I think you were in town and you were looking to record here.
That's right.
Am I misremembering?
Yeah. I mean, not here at your house, although I would have. But, you know, our network has some studios in Hollywood. But, yeah, I was trying to get you on. I don't know if that was the same trip where I had Paul on, because we talked about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, because his real pick, oh, gosh, what's the name of it?
Would it have been Lawrence of Arabia?
No. The one with Jim Broadbent, the period piece.
Oh, he loves Topsy Turvy. Yeah.
Topsy Turvy. But I couldn't find it anywhere. It wasn't streaming, and I think I would have had to order the DVD or something, and
that
didn't happen.
Weird.
So he pivoted to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which was very nice.
Yeah, that's weird. I'm a big Mike Lee fan too. Mm, so
yeah.
weird that it wouldn't have been available.
Do you guys have the Criterion channel, the Criterion app?
I don't think so.
Highly recommend it.
Okay. You know, it's funny I'm on your podcast because I'm kind of like a television fanatic.
Well, we talk about TV and stuff too.
Okay.
I mean, the Friday editions are movie deep dives, but I do a Monday edition called Mini Crush where I just do a lot of fun stuff with the listeners on Facebook and play like little fun games and pose questions. And there's a lot of TV talk there.
Gotcha.
What's your big TV jam lately?
Oh my God. Well, right now we just started this really awesome French spy series called The Bureau.
Right. I haven't seen it. I've heard of it.
Yeah. It's on Sundance now. So you have to like, I don't know. Do you ride the rails of the streamers?
I've got too many. Like, I ditched cable because I was tired of paying that much money, and I think I probably paid just as much money now with all the channels. Yeah. But they're the channels that I want, so I don't mind too much.
Right. Well, so on Sundance now, it's called The Bureau, and it's, like, about, like, their CIA or whatever. Uh-huh. And I guess, like, they call their CIA the Bureau of Legends.
Ooh. What a great name.
But it's really good.
And is it just like spycraft or?
Yeah, spycraft.
Ooh, I love that stuff.
But there are matters of the heart. It's like it's like a humanization of people who do that work, kind of.
Yeah, you don't get to see that a lot either because usually spies are just so, I mean, all you see them doing is spy stuff.
Speaking of spy shows, though, I also loved The Americans. Did you watch?
I did not watch that, but my wife Emily watched it fully, and it was one of those shows where I kind of, and this may happen to you guys too, like one of you sort of gets into a show, and then by the time the other one is like, well, I want to watch that too, they're a fucking season in.
Yeah, I mean, actually that did kind of happen with us with The Americans, and so he was only like two seasons ahead, so I caught up.
Only two seasons?
I know. No, I'm telling you, I'm a TV nut, like fanatic.
Well, maybe I should watch Americans. Emily loved it. She said it was so great.
It's great. It's great. She would like The Bureau then.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we'll check that out. We've been watching, you know, of course, when times are tough, we turn to comedy, and things have been especially tough around here lately. So we've just barreled through What We Do in the Shadows, which was a lot of fun. And before that, we barreled through a show called Red Oaks that Hodgman was on.
I've seen some of Red Oaks. I really liked it. They lost me on one episode.
Which one? The Freaky Friday?
Yes.
It was a little weird.
I was like, this is not the mythology or the world of this show, and it kind of like derailed me a little bit.
Yeah, I will say this for that episode, it was kind of fun, and I give him props for doing something different, but it was definitely like non-canon Red Oaks.
right.
But yeah. I love that show. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, it's good. Paul Reiser, how awesome is he?
Yeah, he was a badass. And
he was pretty awesome.
I think got totally ignored for like Emmy consideration.
Yeah, I think he's doing okay though.
Well, no, I'm not feeling too bad about Paul Reiser.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what else I watch. I've been watching this survival show on Netflix, but that's sort of one of those reality competition shows.
Yeah, like a reality thing or something.
Yeah. It's sort of like a more legit Naked and Afraid, but these are like real survivalists and they're not naked and
or afraid.
Well, no, they're kind of afraid, but just not naked.
They get afraid.
And what else? You got anything else TV wise?
Well, speaking of Sundance, if you do sign up, there was this British show I loved called The Split, and it was about these this female family of divorce lawyers that all had like messy families themselves.
Uh-huh.
So I got really into that.
That sounds great.
I like British stuff.
Yeah, I feel like we could just do nothing but watch British television as if American TV didn't exist, and it would be great.
Yes.
Anything totally. For the BBC is always so fucking good.
I agree.
So I know where you're from because we've chatted before. My friend Mita is also from Charleston, the Mount Pleasant area of South Carolina. And I know you're from there. Were you born there or did you just grow up there?
Oh, no. I'm originally from West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What, and coincidentally, the Charleston area of West Virginia.
Oh,
and
yeah. Then, I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah. And then my parents divorced when I was 8. And then my mom got a job in South Carolina and we moved to South Carolina. So I'm from Charleston to Charleston. True Hollywood stories.
Well, so Charleston, I mean, I've been to both, but Charleston, South Carolina, as you know, because I even invited you guys one time to a beach house where we rented. That's where we vacation every year, Isle of Palms.
Yeah, and I grew up on Sullivan's Island, which is the neighboring island to Isle of Palms.
Okay, you grew up on Sullivan's Island?
Yeah, yeah.
That is, like, amazing. That's just, that's some Prince of Tides shit right there.
It's totally Prince of Tides. I mean, it used to be Prince of Tides. Now it's like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous,
it's
but it was
bougie.
Not before. Before there was like a big hurricane that came through there in 1989 and sort of changed the, shall we say, socioeconomic makeup of the area.
So what happens? A hurricane comes through, knocks down a bunch of houses, then a bunch of richies come in and rebuild.
Yeah, like what happens is like you'll get like a ginormous like insurance payout. And then instead of it being a bunch of like rickety old beach homes that were built in like 1918, it becomes like 1991 McMansion style.
Right.
Yeah, like it changes sort of like a character DNA of the place. Yeah, but it's still a great place to go, but yeah.
No, it's amazing. We go out to eat on Sullivan's Island sometimes, which if you're not familiar with the area, I mean, Sullivan's Island is right next to Isle of Palms and Folly Beach, and they're all just sort of right there together. This last time we went last year, we stayed in this place. It was, it had been added onto, but it was one of the original, I guess, sort of cottages from Isle of Palms that they ended up expanding and macking out. But it was, it still had that character of the old place.
Yes.
Like you could tell where the old place was and it was so fucking cool.
There was actually just an article in, I want to say in April about like the old and the new and sort of like that balance of trying to keep, like there was a real lack of historical preservation in, on the barrier islands there when they started to rebuild and stuff. And it was like a conversation about it. I have to send you a link. It was in the Charleston paper, the Post and Courier.
Yeah. I'd love to see that. I just love that area. We fell in love with the low country and just, I grew up going to Florida, to the Gulf of Florida, because that's where my parents went.
Oh, nice.
It's okay. But you know, once we went to South Carolina, I just loved it so much more. Just, the vibe there was completely different than it was in Florida, and the people, and it was just, it's amazing.
I have a feeling the vibe anywhere outside of Florida is completely different than Florida.
That's a good point.
No offense to your Florida listeners. I just, you know.
Oh, I think they're used to it. Florida takes a lot of shit these days.
They do. That's a really big state too. How crazy big is Florida? Like if you ever drive, I've like driven from Charleston to the Keys.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago. But like, you just can't believe how long Florida is.
Oh, it's long. Like I live in Atlanta and Miami is as close to me as New York. And
that's so wild.
Yeah, it's a long way down there. And there's a bunch of different Floridas too. Because you've got the Gulf and you've got Miami and then you've got inland Florida and then the Clearwater sort of retirement area. And then northern Florida, like where Jacksonville and St. Augustine and stuff.
Yeah.
It's really diverse, but not.
It is. Unlike the Everglades, you've got swampy Florida.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess that's the inland. Yeah.
But, Charleston just won me over. I mean, we get into town when we go occasionally. Mainly, we just set up on the beach and, like, hang out at the house and go to, what's the seafood place right there that I go? that has the key lime pie.
You're giving me vibes. You're giving me vibes.
It's just the best.
Isn't it the best? Do y'all just fly there? Because it's like a 30-minute, it's like a 40-minute flight from ATL.
We drive because we bring so much shit with us, and we bring our dogs and cats. We always have to get a place that allows the animals.
That's like a 5-hour drive, right?
Yeah, it's no big deal at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can have dogs on the beach after a certain date in September. And so we always book it after that because we can bring the dogs down there.
Best time to book it in. I mean, it's so hot there right now.
Yeah, it's brutal. Yeah. And it's hot in September, but it's cooling down just a tiny bit, just enough.
Yes, yes. Agree.
And I know we were talking, you and I were talking at one point about not us buying a place, but I was looking at properties and you were like, we've done the math. It's cheaper to rent. And it totally is.
Well, it is because of how much it costs now to own there. And not to mention your property tax, but also you're required to have flood insurance.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a lot.
And it's not cheap because you're right. Like you're on a coastal flood, flood zone. I mean, when I was there and the hurricane came through, like the entire island was completely the entire Sullivan's Island was completely underwater.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's scary.
Was totally submerged.
Good Lord.
At the height of the storm. Yeah.
Is hurricane season just like super stressful for everyone, or are they just used to it?
Yeah. That's another thing. If you owned there, you'd have to be stressing about the hurricanes.
Yeah, that's no good.
No, it's no good.
Now, when did you start acting? Did you act when you were growing up there, like in high school theater and stuff?
You know what? I did, actually. That's sort of when I started, I kind of fell in love with it. Is this the podcast, by the way?
This is the podcast.
Oh, okay. I thought we were just chatting. I was like, fine with it. Now I'm like worried I'm being boring. I am. Well, in Charleston, there was, I've always been interested in storytelling, you know? And stories and stuff. And there was a theater there. It's like the oldest theater in town, the Dock Street Theater. And they had like a little, acting classes for students and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I got, that was sort of like a side interest. I wasn't, going after I didn't have stage parents or anything. It was like my hobby, I guess. And then in high school, we did stuff. And I went to an all-girls high school. And so all of the male parts would be played by women, her young women and stuff like that. So I was always sort of involved, and I knew I wanted to get serious about studying acting. So I sort of pursued it more in college and graduate level. But yeah.
Now, where'd you go to college?
I ended up going to the University of South Carolina in Columbia, which is about 2 hours northwest of Charleston, big state school. And that was fun. And I got involved in theater there, and it was a more liberal arts type of a degree, like a Bachelor of Arts. And but I knew people in the theater program that had gone on to study more conservatory style in master's programs. So I got serious about pursuing a master's at the end of my bachelor's career. And then I ended up going, I didn't get in the first time around. Maybe this is interesting, but, you kind of audition for these programs and, I didn't get in the first time around. So I saved all my money. I was waiting tables, and then I was trying to get better and pick a better monologue and all that. And then, my second go around, I ended up getting an offer for a full scholarship at SMU in Dallas.
So you went
and
to study graduate?
I couldn't turn that down.
Oh, no, that's amazing. Do you remember what you auditioned with?
It was an Irish. It was something Irish. I did I worked on the dialect and everything. Now I'm going to have to look it up. It was the Irish Troubles.
Yeah. Potato famine.
Yes. And then I guess I must have done a comedic, and it might have had to have been a classical. I probably did some Shakespeare or something. And And then you had to sing like a few bars a cappella something, even though it wasn't a musical program, but
yeah,
I can't remember what I did.
Can you sing?
No. I mean, I can carry a tune. I shouldn't say no off the bat, but I don't consider myself musical.
Right. Because that, I mean, that's a, I can sing a little bit that's too, but that's a whole different deal when you're talking about theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I was in my choir like in high school, but yeah. I was not the soloist, if that makes sense.
Yes. I was church choir. And then, my wife was show choir. High school. Yeah, which is a whole different deal.
Show choir sounds more fun. Like you would sing more fun songs than the church choir.
Yeah, and it was you performed like there were like dance routines and stuff in show choir.
Got it.
Yeah.
It was like an inner, it was, you're putting on a show.
Yeah, it was a total show. I've seen some of the tapes. It's kind of fun.
I was in a choir in when I finished drama school, I moved to New York City because I thought I could get on Broadway.
That's what you do.
And I mean, I was trying to. And I was a part of a choir called the New York City Labor Chorus. And the one requirement was that you had to be a member of a labor union. Oh, and wow. I was the only Screen Actors Guild Actors Equity member in the choir. But we would sing like, you know, like protesty kind of songs, like We Shall Overcome and stuff.
What were the other union members like? Just all sorts of stuff?
Like Teamsters and like wow. office worker, like real blue collar.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was cool. Like, and then like if there would be like a protest where they would get one of those giant like inflatable rats or something. Uh-huh. Then like we'd show up and do stuff like that.
That's so fucking cool.
It was really weird.
How long were you?
But I liked it a lot.
How long were you there in New York?
I was only there for 2 years because I was there like the 9/11 attacks happened, uh-huh. and I just had to leave.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't a good scene for me. And then I came out to LA.
And you went out to LA to again try acting.
Yes. And really what happened was I got real with myself because I love television. Uh-huh. I think we established that. And I really, even when I was thinking like I would do theater, it was for me, it was always like a path mm-hmm. to TV stuff because I was always sort of under the impression that if you were a stage actor, people, you were desirable in the television world.
Right.
But apparently that's not true.
Oh, really?
Not for me. No, I guess it's true. I guess there's some truth to it. But nowadays, I think there's so many mediums. I mean, like people do stuff online or, mm-hmm. you know, or you might be like an influencer or something and get attention that way. And I don't know.
No, give me a
there's
break.
There's other ways. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, were you like, I want to be on a sitcom? I mean, was that what your goal was as a TV head?
Pretty much any good television. Like I have no snobbery about it, except I love great comedy and everything, but I do love prestige drama
mm-hmm.
a lot. Like,
yeah.
I watch a lot of it. But there's, I also like dramedy too. So
yeah.
I feel like that's maybe my sweet spot is that I feel like I could be someone really funny in a serious comedy or something like that, which kind of leads us to our movie, but we don't have to go there yet.
Well, no, but we will.
Okay.
Do you have like the serious dramatic chops? Like, can you go there?
I mean, I'm trained to go there, but I don't think a lot of directors probably see me that way. I mostly go into comedy rooms, uh-huh. audition for comedy rooms, but, yeah, I can go there. I mean, I was trained to go there, but I don't know. I probably am not as... I don't have like the natural gravitas maybe of some dramatic actors, but
Yeah, but you don't like gravitas is it's a fine trait, but I don't think you need gravitas to bring it dramatically, you know?
I guess. I mean, like, is Gary Oldman doing a lot of sitcoms? I say that and he might have, and I don't know.
I don't think he is. Okay. I mean, it's much harder to be funny, I think.
I think it is. I mean, I feel grateful that I can do a little bit of both because it does give you more flexibility and opportunities.
Yeah, for sure. I remember seeing at one point, it feels like a couple of years ago, you did a play in Edinburgh.
Yes, I did. Yes.
What was that all about? And,
well, that was a fun sort of happy accident where I had participated. So there was a writer at the same agency I was in, and they wanted to do a table read of this play that she had written. Her and her husband, he's an actor, she's a writer, and he's an awesome actor, Danny O'Brien. He's done a lot of comedy and stuff. And they were doing a table read, and so the agency had reached out and said, hey, do you want to try to do this table read at our, it was just like an in-house, you know, thing. And I was like, sure. I mean, why not? And so it was a comedic play that she'd written called Mary Go Nowhere. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun. And a couple of weeks later, the husband and wife had decided they wanted to take it to Edinburgh because Danny had been to Edinburgh in the past. And the way that that festival, the Fringe Festival, works is if you can get a venue, you can do your show.
Oh, cool.
There's really no like vetting process or anything like that.
Right.
Like, in fact, that festival is wild. Like, it blew my mind because that festival is so huge. It's an entire month long, the month of August.
Yeah.
There were over 3,000 shows.
Wow.
In the festival. So when you get there and you're like, oh, I want to look at some of these shows and get, it's like you get like a phone book.
Yeah.
They have like a special app on your phone where you can pull up the app if you're in a certain area of town and it'll tell you the 20 shows around you that are starting within an hour where you're standing.
Holy cow.
So the entire city of Edinburgh, which I'd never been to before, is completely taken over by theater nerds. No, like everybody, musicians, comedians, everybody, circus, everything. And every single inch of that town, which is a medium-sized town normally, becomes a venue. Like a closet in a coffee shop will become a venue.
Wow.
I mean, it is just wild. And millions of people flood through Edinburgh for this festival. And I guess like a lot of people who live there sometimes leave town because they don't want to be overrun by the festival.
Yeah.
They go on holiday and then they rent out their flats and stuff, which is what our production did. We rented two flats. We were like a cast of 9 people.
Uh-huh.
And half the cast lived in one and half the cast lived in the other, like
fun.
A couple blocks from each other. Yeah. So it was like real fun, guerrilla.
God, that sounds like it would be so much fun. We did a Stuff You Should Know UK tour and we went to Edinburgh for a show. And
oh, wow.
It was just like...
For the festival.
No. It was pre-festival, but a lot of the posters, I think it was in... I'd have to look. I think it was in June or something, but there were already a lot of posters up. But that town was just unbelievable. Like, I was just walking around thinking, is this even real or am I at Epcot or something?
I could not agree more. I mean, as someone who loves Charleston, like anything with charm, right? Or like history feel, you know,
totally.
It kind of in a weird way reminded me because it felt like a similar size.
Uh-huh.
It's probably a little bigger, but like, and everywhere you look is like visually juicy, you know, like I loved it so much. Even if you were there for like, say you were super rich and you were there for the festival and you were like, I'm going to see a show every, like, I'm going to see a show from morning to night for all of August. I did the math. I'm not great at math, but you still could only possibly see not even 10% of all of the shows.
Wow.
Because yeah, there are crazy. That many shows.
Man, it must be so much fun during the festival. Like, it was an amazing place, but I'm trying to imagine it full of actors and comedians and.
Yeah. It was great. I saw so many shows. I, cause also when you're in the festival, you get like a badge.
Oh yeah.
And it, and if you're like, if you're the tier of the festival you're in, you get to see shows, those shows for free if they're empty seats.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But, yeah, it's really hard though to, it's hard to get a show seen there though.
Yeah. I bet too much stuff going on, huh?
There's too much stuff going on and you have to come in so hardcore with like reviews and stuff from like New York Times or something.
Yeah. How did you guys do with your play? How was it?
We did not do well with it.
Oh no.
But it was a very underattended. I mean, we had a great time and I loved my cast and I wouldn't change that experience for the world.
Yeah.
Because it was sort of, it was just a newer show. It was a new original show and yeah. We didn't have like a huge name draw or anything like that.
Right.
And it was in the afternoon and it wasn't exactly kid friendly, you know?
Right.
But so there's just a lot of producing elements that you have to kind of cover if you think you want to take a show to Edinburgh because.
Yeah, I bet. Well, you went to Edinburgh, you're in a play, you had your nights free.
I saw shows every night.
I bet it was so much fun.
Yeah, it was so much fun. It was so much fun. I can't, I feel terrible because, you know, our show didn't do, I wish that I could have brought something to like some, I wish I had like some like Meryl Streep fame that could have brought people to the show because these were my friends that were producing it and yeah. I wanted them to come out ahead, you know, but
now did you make like lifelong buddies too?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Like the people in my show, I love so much. They're like so talented. Yeah, definitely. And we're all based in LA. So,
oh, cool. Well, that's amazing.
Yeah. Mike, do you know Mike McShane? He was in the show. Michael McShane. He's a famous improviser.
I don't think so.
Yeah. He does Edinburgh, like, he's, like, famous in Edinburgh.
Oh, really?
It's like, he's part of that show Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Oh, okay. I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. They're big over there in the UK.
Yeah.
They like they improv and stuff, yeah. But, yeah, no, it was fun.
Now, what kind of stuff, before, you know, the great pandemic hit, what kind of stuff do you... Like, what's it like as an actor auditioning and what kind of stuff do you go out for? And just give me a sense of that.
That's a great question. Thanks. That's a good question. Thank you for asking that, because that is something I don't talk about it a lot, but being an actor is, it is a mental exercise. Uh-huh. It is like, there's a lot of psychological athleticism to it because they're, you know, before the pandemic, and I've had some auditions during the pandemic through Zoom and stuff like that, but although I don't understand how they're going to shoot stuff, but they're trying to figure that out. You know, you're on call all the time.
Yeah.
You're worried, like, if you leave town,
right,
that they're gonna be like, oh, you got the callback for Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
And you're like in the middle of nowhere and you can't, you know. Although that's never happened to me, but I'm sure it's happened to somebody.
Right.
You're just on call all the time. You get like, sometimes you get close to jobs. I've never said this on a thing. Well, maybe I can say it more, but I was up for a role. It would have just been like one day in a movie, but it was like one of my favorite directors of all time.
Uh-huh.
And I was so like, I would have died if I'd gotten it. And he wanted to call me directly on the phone.
Oh, wow.
And he left me like a message on my phone, which I I said I would never delete in my life. And I don't know if I would have gotten the role. I actually found out like a couple months later, a friend of mine was also up for the same role, but the movie fell through. So yeah, there were some life rights involved and I guess the guy backed out.
Well, does when something like that happens though, do you feel like you get on a director's radar for future work?
You do, but you know, it's one of those things where you're like, what are the chances? Like when it, like his next project, this guy's like a awesome film director, you know, takes so long to put a movie together. Will there be roles even remotely, you know, remotely for me?
Right.
That are appropriate. Yeah, you do. You do. You do. And then you, I think more importantly, and this is sort of, there's a ground game in acting is you feel like, oh, I've gotten on that casting director's radar.
Right.
Because they're the ones that are doing project after project, maybe three projects at the same time, you know, and hopefully they'll call you in.
Yeah, because it's a little bit about the hustle. Like aside from just doing your best and having a great audition, like what mm-hmm. what else can you do outside of all of that stuff to get jobs and to like for the hustle part?
I think generate work for yourself. One of the things okay. I try to do is right now I'm writing a pilot. I hope to send around when I'm finished with it.
Awesome.
It's really close to being finished. Try to pitch ideas, like get in on pitch meetings, try to stretch yourself into these other little avenues of the industry.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Try to get on, like do plays. I know they don't pay anything, but like, you know, when I was in Edinburgh, like the play didn't do well, but, you know, like the few people that came to see the play, one of them is now the development director at a big, you know, whatever. And you keep, you know, you just keep a running list of everyone you come into contact with. It's
right.
like politics in a weird way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
totally.
You send thank you cards or you send emails or, uh-huh. or just try to stay, you know, there's a networking element, I guess.
Yeah.
Podcasting, I guess. Podcasting is exposure.
Yeah, totally. I didn't really think about that.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I'm not the best person to give advice because I'm unemployed right now.
Well, I mean, actors are always unemployed until they have that next that's job. And then when it's over, you're unemployed again.
That's very true. That's very true. And it's easy to like compare your career to other careers. And that's never a good thing because they're never similar careers.
Right. Yeah. I imagine it's really tough to. And this was sort of even I used to work on film crews. I kind of came up as a PA in an art department and stuff before mm-hmm. I had a big career change. But when TV commercials and music videos would get slow and you wouldn't work for a few weeks, that paranoia kind of sets in because you think everyone else is working but me. And you start calling around and like, are you working? And usually no one's working in the case of crews, but sometimes they are and it feels shitty.
Yeah, totally. Totally. That's the thing about the psychological athleticism, because you have to kind of like, while you're constantly networking, generating your own work, and then also being audition ready at any given moment of your life, you're also trying to develop like a healthy ego,
right?
You know, mental health, you know, eating well, sleeping well.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, it's like your whole freaking life.
Yeah.
It's not, you know.
You got to be a complete human with or without it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really interesting stuff. You want to, oh, real quick before we get going on Big Chill, you mentioned like they're trying to figure it out. My friend, you know, so much production here in Atlanta. My friend is just getting cranking on a big, big, big movie in a few weeks here. Sure. And they are bubbling everybody. They are putting everyone in a hotel, even if they live in Atlanta, 7 days a week. They're paying them for 7 days and they're feeding them three meals a day. And you're not allowed to see your wife or your husband or your partner. they are just basically quarantining everybody together, shuttling them to set and back and forth to the hotel, and that's it.
How long is the production?
3 months.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a big movie. It's
that's dedication.
Yeah, and you know, of course, productions are going to have to spend a lot more money to do that kind of thing, but the alternative is just not shoot movies. Well,
yeah, they'll lose money if they don't make the content, and guess what? They have money.
Yeah, they totally have money.
These studios and streaming places, like, by the way, like, I don't know, like, I'm kind of a news junkie. Uh-huh. Netflix, I think, has had, like, an explosion in earnings.
Oh, really?
During the pandemic. Yeah.
Oh, well, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just sort of.
Start doling it out.
I think there's money. Yeah, totally. Start making some content. Bubble me. I'm ready to bubble.
Yeah. I mean, I miss movies. I miss new movies.
Yeah.
And that's going to, like, I miss going to the movies. I miss going to the Vista. I used to live in Los Feliz when I lived there. I knew you guys lived there for a while. And the Vista in the was just like my haven, you know?
Yeah, we actually, my husband and I, Paul, who you know, mm-hmm. We lived behind the Vista for almost 5 years.
Oh, yeah. I know right where that is.
Yeah. So we would walk down the street and see movies at the Vista. And there used to be a Mexican restaurant there, but I think they got rid of it. Kind of nearby.
Which like, one?
Gosh, was it? Was it El Chavo? El Chavo.
I know totally what you're talking about.
Yeah, El Chavo. So we would like eat at El Chavo and then go see a movie at the Vista and walk back.
Yeah.
And it would be like the funnest night ever.
And then get haircuts at Rudy's.
Yeah, Paul got haircuts at Rudy's. I have a lady that I go to, but yeah, Paul would get haircuts at Rudy's.
It's funny. I go to Rudy's here in Atlanta, and I kind of have a thing for Rudy's because I went there in L.A. so much. I lived over, I lived at like Santa Monica and Vermont, so just a few blocks south of Los Feliz proper. And
great.
I just loved Rudy's, and every time I go to a city with a Rudy's, I will get my hair cut. So I've got my hair cut at Rudy's in like New York and Seattle and Denver and Atlanta, LA.
I think that's great.
It's fun.
I like that.
It's my Rudy's.
That's your Rudy's brand loyalty. They should sponsor this episode.
Oh, they totally should. Throw some money
or some episodes.
If that happens, I'll split it with you. How about that?
That's too generous, but thank you.
All right, so we can get into the Big Chill. The let's celebrate the boomers, you know.
Yeah, celebrate the boomers.
The movie from 19.
I mean, the generation that you love and hate, the boomers.
Yeah. So here's my deal with this movie: is I am 49 years old.
And okay.
This movie came out when I was 12. And my household was not an entertainment, like we watched TV and stuff, but we didn't like go to the movies as a family or listen to music. Like my parents never said, oh boy, you should listen to this or you should see this or anything like that. I was kind of on my own with my brother. And we totally found our music and our movies on our own. But the one thing that we had in our house was the goddamn soundtrack to The Big Chill. Like on a loop. And I did that silly Facebook thing that was going around that your 10 most influential albums recently. And I did that. And I kind of had to think really hard about like what influential really means and not just favorite or I'm trying to be cool. And I put the Big Chill soundtrack on there because I was 12 years old and I was introduced to Motown in a big, big way because of that soundtrack.
I mean, that's interesting because, I feel like we're not that far apart in age, and I had boomer parents and stuff. I feel like growing up as a Gen Xer, like I could not escape boomer anything.
Yeah.
Like it permeated every cell. I mean, you know, it was like the music and the ethos and the this and the that.
Yeah.
And there was just kind of an obsession with it when I was coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this soundtrack was huge. It was one of the big soundtracks of the 80s. And
totally. I think totally.
Kind of like an influential soundtrack, period. And they even totally. Make a big deal about it in the movie. You know, there's that great yes. part where Kevin Kline, or I think Jeff Goldblum says, you know, can we listen to something else? There's been a lot of good music. And he was like, there is no other music in my house.
Yes.
Like, this
yes.
is this is what we listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. I just felt like, I would say it's probably one of the greatest movie soundtracks of all time.
Oh, absolutely. And as a 12-year-old who grew up listening to American Top 40 and a total MTV junkie, like that's all I did was watch MTV, which gave me a lot of good music, but I had never heard Aretha Franklin and Smokey Robinson. And this, this opened the door to all that stuff. And then in Motown, like we listen to a lot of Motown in my house today.
Yeah.
A lot of Motown playlists and stuff. And it's a lot of, I mean, that came straight from the Big Chill.
Yeah, it's like classical music. It's like Beethoven.
Yeah, you're totally right.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Big Chill is another thing that I love about movies that have just a really basic, simple premise as, totally. as a jumping off point. And this movie sets it up so well at the beginning with that, you know, it's a funeral and a yes. bunch of old friends that haven't seen each other in a long time. And go, there's your movie.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we had recently watched, I had just rewatched the Big Chill kind of recently, but Paul had never seen, Body Heat.
Oh man. Great movie.
Which is also Lawrence Kasdan.
Yes. And William Hurt, right?
Yes. Yes. William Hurt and everything. Yeah. And like Lawrence Kasdan is, I mean, he's like written a bunch of like Star Wars movies and stuff.
Yeah, he wrote Empire, and I think he worked on one of the new ones. I don't remember which one, but
yeah.
I think sort of an underrated director. When I look through his list of movies, there are some real good ones, and he hasn't done a great movie in a long time. But The Accidental Tourist and Body Heat and The Big Chill, like these are some really, really great movies of the 80s.
Yes, and The Big Chill, I think he captures in his writing and he directed it, right? Big Chill.
Yeah. He directed it and then, co-wrote it. Let me see. I meant,
oh yeah. He co-wrote it with a female writer.
Yeah. Barbara Benedict.
But like, I think the feat that he accomplished of capturing a group of people staying in a house over a weekend, like the whole feeling. Yeah. I mean, you almost feel like you're staying in this vacation house with these people.
Yeah. And it also, it manages to like throw some kind of tropey stuff in there without it kind of tainting the experience. Like all the characters are, I was watching last night and I was thinking like, oh, there's the guy who's still doing drugs. There's the guy who kind of forgot where he came from and has sort of sold out from, I guess that's sort of Kevin Kline is the big businessman now.
Yeah. He's going to make a lot of money.
Yeah. And they all seem a little tropey, but then I thought, you know what, if you take a cross section of anyone that age, which is hysterical because they were like 35, I think. I'm literally like
I know.
15 years older than the Big Chill people were.
I know, right?
It's kind of sad, but also like they still seem older than me somehow.
Yeah.
But if you took a cross section of any group of friends in their mid-30s or mid-40s or whatever, it does kind of look like that. I mean, it's a trope for a reason. Like if I looked at my friends, you know, I work in podcasting. My friend owns a wine store. Another one sells insurance. And there's just yeah. this big range, you know, especially when you get out of LA and not everyone you know is in the film industry. People do a lot of different jobs, and that's what it looks like in real life.
I think the reason that it's successful in that, too, is the casting is so amazing. Yeah. Like, those actors are so real.
Oh, so good.
I mean, it, you know, I like if I were to think if someone was like pitching a movie today and they're like, it's going to be a bunch of like adults at this turning point in their life dealing with a friend's death in a house for a weekend, like they would make it so everyone is so cartoonish.
Yeah.
Well, like he sold out. Not only did he sell out for money, he's like a hedge fund manager that, you know, and he's, you overhear him on the phone, like firing, you know, someone with an orphan who's raising an orphan or something.
Correct. That would.
And then, and then the tone is so special because he trusts you to just like absorb into the world so organically. And if they were to make that movie today, they would make it so crazy chaotic. Like there's the scene where the bat comes in the house.
Yeah.
But it feels real. Like we've all been in that house where the bird flew in. And but if they did it in like today's time, like they would knock over like a huge china cabinet and like it would be so chaotic and cartoonish.
Yeah, something would catch on fire.
Yeah, it wouldn't feel real. And and I think he strikes a note with those particular actors who are, I mean, it's got to be one of the greatest ensemble of actors of all time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's go through the cast a little bit. It's a movie that underuses Glenn Close. So that kind of tells you a lot.
Yeah.
Kevin.
Well, it is an ensemble.
That's
so
true. That is true.
Yeah.
My only beef at all is, and you being from the South too, I'm sure you, this is sort of a sticking point with you with accents, but, and I never noticed it before, but Kevin Kline is the only one that kind of.
He's the only one.
Yeah. It's not great.
He's good at them too. I think, doesn't he do one in, I'm going to say something wrong. Did he do one in Sophie's Choice?
I don't know. I haven't seen that in so long. But he's good at accents generally, but it's, the Southern accent is so hard. And you know how it is in movies when you're from the South. Yes. It's just never right.
I mean, I guess like in my mind, the way I made it sound, the way I justified it was like Kevin Kline probably did like his whole character's backstory.
Yeah.
And is like from South Carolina because the movie takes place in South Carolina in his home, like near Beaufort or something like that. And but they all met at University of Michigan.
Right.
So I was like, well, maybe they all like or from the Midwest or something like that.
Yeah. You know, I just picked up on that last night that they met at Michigan. I always kind of figured they were all from South Carolina, but I don't think that's the case. Alex, who, you know, obviously everyone kind of knows this by now. It was Kevin Costner cast in that role. Alex, who has died, he lived there because that's where the funeral was. And he had the affair with Sarah, with Kevin Kline's wife.
Right.
But yeah, I don't think the rest of them were supposed to be from South Carolina.
And also maybe Kevin Costner in his cutout scenes did a Southern accent because
I could see that.
I could see him doing it because of Bull Durham and stuff. And
right. So you've got Kline, who's just a master. Tom Berenger, who was so good in this as sort of a Tom Selleck type guy.
Yes, and he, I love his character because he's like an actor and he's on some cheesy television show.
TJ Lancer.
And he's like embarrassed of it.
Yeah, it's funny because he's, and you know this as an actor and being around actors, he's so insecure and just needs that validation, which is a bit of a tropey thing, but it works well for this movie because he's this big famous guy, but he gets around his friends and they kind of make fun of him a little bit. In a fun way, you know, they're nice, but.
Yeah, it's really smart. The writing, I even like the detail, though, that they are in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Maybe Kevin Kline is from South Carolina and they met in Michigan. Like Lawrence Kasdan, just he makes it real.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
He makes it real. Yeah.
Mary Kay Place. How much do we love Mary Kay Place?
Oh, my gosh.
She's so great.
Awesome. She's awesome. She still works now, doesn't she?
She does. And I feel like
I saw her in something kind of recently.
She's so underrated. Like I never hear anyone talking about how great she was, and she's probably still great. But in the 80s, she was such a good character actor and in so many good movies and just had such a warm, you just want to hug her. She seems so lovable.
And like someone, you know,
Yeah.
She seems like someone you know.
Yeah, and she's so good as Meg, trying to get pregnant.
So good.
And I thought all that stuff was played so real as well. And today it would have been, if there was a character trying to get pregnant from one of her friends, it would have been so kind of corny and hokey.
It would have been overwrought. It would have been like, there would have been like just like virtue signaling issues embedded in the dialogue.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, because you can't have a comedy today unless there's some reference to what people are trending on Twitter or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it was so real. And you've got, I mean, the way she played it with Behringer and everyone's sort of turning her down. William Hurt is turning her down because I think it's implied that he
can't get it up.
Yeah, that's the deal, right?
Because he's from Vietnam or something, right? Like he.
Oh, is that it?
Something happened to him.
Oh,
over
so
there.
That's okay. I wasn't sure that's what he meant when he said, "Did I ever tell you what happened to me in Vietnam?" That's right before the bat comes in.
Yeah, and I think it means he can't get an erection anymore.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And then you've got Jeff Goldblum waiting in the wings.
Yes.
He's like, "What am I, chuff liver?" And I was watching him, and I was like, "How is Jeff Goldblum more handsome in his 60s than he was in his 30s?"
He's so kind of dorky, huh? But he still was cute. He was cute.
I mean, he was cute, but he was kind of, I don't know, he's kind of gangly. I think he grew into himself as an older man in a very sort of way that I never
dignified,
will.
Yeah, more like distinguished or something. Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got a very undersold Meg Tilly.
Oh, Meg Tilly.
She does such a good job with so little in this, I think.
Oh my God. I think she's brilliant. I think she's brilliant.
She is. She's great. She doesn't have a lot to work with. And it's a tough role as the one outsider of this group of close knit friends who is kind of stuck almost in this house.
Yeah. And she's like of a different generation than they are. And
yeah, she's the younger girl.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of her, performance was physical. Like she's like doing like those splits and
yeah, clearly a dancer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that was just such a memorable, what a great layer, you know, that she's so limber with her body and their bodies are starting to break.
Yeah.
You know?
I didn't really think about that juxtaposition.
Yeah. Cause like one can't get pregnant. One can't get it up.
Right. That's true. And they don't, and again, I hate to keep saying this, but if this movie were made today, they would have really overdone her,
totally.
Her youth and vitality, whereas here it's just sort of a little subtle layer.
Yeah, if this movie were done today, there'd be a joke about TikTok, and they'd be like, is that a clock? Like, the studio would not have allowed Lawrence Kasdan to fully flesh out real people.
Yeah.
They would be like, you know.
Yeah, you're totally right. And then rounding out the cast, you have Jo Beth Williams, who I think is also really, really underused. And she's
her
just so good.
Her performance is touching because she's like this like unsatisfied, wealthy housewife.
Yeah.
And that is a trope, but it's a real thing.
It is. And, you know, all you're doing is waiting for her husband to leave so she can get down with Tom Behringer.
Right. Right. Yes. Yes.
Cause they clearly had this old love that was never sort of happened. And, I love how she kind of stands up to him in that one scene too, where he says something about like, you know, he left his wife cause he got bored and he was like, if we actually do this, that might happen with us too. And she's kind of like, fuck you, man.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. It's like a real conversation, that you might have with, you know, your old flame from decades before.
Yeah, absolutely. Another one of my favorite moments is when it's sort of early on when they all decide they can all stay there and they're all in different rooms, getting the beds together and getting the beds made up. And,
yes.
Behringer and Kevin Kline are in that amazing attic room with that super cool roof line.
Yes.
And I'm such a house fiend and architecture fiend. All I could do is like look at this house and these roof lines and go like, oh my God. But he says, they're talking about, these are the two guys that have made a lot of money. And they have that one line about being former revolutionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And Klein looks to him and he says, yeah, but we don't need the money though, right? In a way that it's like, yeah, they both love the money.
Right. Right. Like that, like they didn't know what it was like to make money before and how that would drive them.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's easy. Yeah. It's easy to say who needs it when you don't have it.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, like, that's such a, every little moment drives the theme of the movie in such a subtle, nuanced, character-driven way.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, like, bang us over the head with it. I don't know.
No, I thought it was really subtle.
Yeah.
And there's no nuance anymore, I feel like, in life or in film.
No, Chuck, there is no more nuance. And
Emily's always talking about that.
I talk about this a lot. I really do crave and miss nuance.
Yeah.
And I honestly think it's necessary to make us like deep thinkers and intellectually consistent when we're thinking about things. I don't know.
Yeah, Janie. and I got this feeling when we hung out that one time at Max FunCon that weekend, I was like, you and my wife would love each other. You guys would be pals.
I'd love to meet your wife. I'm sorry she was not there.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun. And she rails about the lack of nuance like on a daily basis in today's society, how everything is just black and white and you can't have any real conversation without like planting your flag so firmly in one camp or the other.
I hate it because it's so judgmental. It's like you're having a conversation. That's a great way to put it, is about planting your flag somewhere. Because you can't like honestly process and think through where you might fall on something without like a cacophony of voices from one side or the other screaming you down.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm talking a lot about like social media too, but I guess social media is part of our lives now, but
yeah, for better or worse.
Unfortunately. but even just like media in general, I mean, you try to seek out news, which is we all have been doing because we want to know what's going on with the pandemic and the economy and the election and stuff like that. And it's just so crazy. It's so crazy that people go so far. Anyway, I don't know. I'm not saying anything that people don't know.
I know, but I'm with you. It's a very discouraging time to be in America.
It's a very discouraging time. I could not agree more. And I know our entertainment like reflects where we are and all this stuff, but like, you know, something as simple as The Big Chill, just like sort of exploring certain adult emotions and life changes and relationships, examining old friendships. Those small things are so relevant at any given moment in time.
Yeah.
To any group of people, any group, any walk of life, you know.
Yeah.
That I miss stuff like that in entertainment.
Yeah, and the other thing this movie did so well, I think, was for a movie that's about a bunch of friends getting together and aging and kind of talking about what's the meaning of life because their friend just died by suicide, it doesn't go like there's surprisingly few scenes of them kind of getting all tropey with those discussions. It's really, there's a couple of them here and there, and you would understand that because that's really going to happen in life. But it's really just about them reconnecting and just enjoying each other for a little bit.
Yes. And I like that it makes you feel the emotions that they are feeling.
Yeah.
I like stories that make you feel and are less about our hero does this and then faces consequences and then overcomes. Like, that's useful and is very prevalent, but I love the sort of like character, the journey of like the human condition.
Yeah.
And I just, I don't see that movie getting made today unless it's some indie filmmaker doing it. And then there's no way they can do it as good as Lawrence Kasdan.
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned that, because when I was watching it last night, I was kind of thinking this has the DNA of an independent film in a lot of ways, but it's also just a movie, like a good old Hollywood movie. Like there are a couple of corny montages, like the, the when they're dancing in the house, and then where they're playing football, and it's so cornball. Yeah. And but it's fun. Like it's a real movie, but it has that sort of DNA of an independent film, I think.
It has the DNA of an independent film with like a blockbuster cast.
Yeah.
And that doesn't get made today.
Yeah. And some of the jokes too are sort of good old fashioned movie jokes, like the recurring bit with Goldblum sleeping late and always getting
he
up.
He misses everything. All the time.
And he misses it. And he has that one great line. I think it's either, I think they probably do it three times, a rule of threes, but it's always Glenn Close who's the only one there after everything has happened. And Goldblum wanders in and he just sits down with her and looks around and he goes, "Are we the first ones up?"
The timing on that is so great too.
It is.
And it's after that long, speaking of montages, isn't it right after, isn't there like a long, oh no, I know. Isn't it after, no, I'm wrong. But there's that scene in the kitchen where they just set the camera up and show like, it's like a time lapse.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Scene. Uh-huh. You know, I love that scene.
Yeah, and even the corny football stuff is kind of fun because, you know, you probably would go out and throw the football around. They're a bunch of big Michigan football fans.
Yes.
The other thing I thought was cool was how, and I never really noticed this in other viewings, was aside from the funeral, and then I guess the cop comes to the house, there's no one else in the movie. And even the scene with that great shot of Kevin Kline and William Hurt, when he's on his morning run and William Hurt's walking along with him down the middle of the street.
It's like a ghost town.
Yeah. There's no one, there's no extras, there's no anything. And it's that had an effect, I think, of these people, just like all the focus being so firmly rooted on this cast.
Yes. It has such a good observation.
It's weird. It's almost like a horror movie.
I love it. One of the things I love, you mentioned the funeral scene, which is the opening of the movie.
Yeah, and really long.
Yeah, it's really long. And this is where we're introduced to every single main character of the movie. I mean, and he introduces the cat, the ensemble cat. It's so perfect. Like everybody's reaction to what's going on. You can kind of, it's like he's planting the seed of who they are instantaneously. And then when they start playing on the organ, the Rolling Stones, oh, you can't always get what you want.
So great.
Like, you know, now what you're in for, you know, exactly the tone of this movie.
Yeah. And I'm always harp on the show about efficiency of character setup. And he's so efficient with how he does that in that funeral scene. You know who all these people are. And Joe Beth Williams hits down that organ and it segues into the real song. And it also sets you up for the soundtrack, too.
Yes, it does. It does. The awesome soundtrack.
Which, you know, at the end that finally comes around with the great sequence to You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. When everyone's kind of pairing off and bedding down for the night, kind of hooking up. It feels like that summer camp, like the last night of summer camp when everyone's finally hooking up a little bit.
Yeah.
And such a sweet thing that Glenn Close allows for her friend, you know, I just couldn't even get over it.
I know that is. Yeah. I guess like maybe he was saying like in their own ways, they are revolutionaries. Like they can be revolutionary within the boundaries of their friendships and relationships and be empathic and give in ways that maybe aren't like, you know, marching on Washington and toppling the patriarchy or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe.
No, I agree. And I think, again, it's so subtle in the way he just sort of hints at their past. There's the one line about revolutionaries. And then I think Goldblum or Kline has a line about owning a house or whatever. And they never thought when they were young. And he goes, yeah, that's when property was a crime. It's just a couple of lines in the movie. And if it were made today, it would be so overdone. They would talk about, they would get in these big arguments about how they used to be and how they challenged the man and the establishment. Yeah.
And then there would be flashbacks.
Yeah, you're probably right.
With young, hot actors playing them that don't look anything like them.
It's so true. And, you know, at the end, they Mary Kay Place and Kevin Kline have sex to get her pregnant. And it's such a sweet, tender scene. And just, yeah. It's just so well played, I think.
It's just such like a pure act of generosity and compassion and not cheap in any way.
Yeah. And she has that line earlier when she's talking to Glenn Close about it, about getting one of the guys there to impregnate her. And she's like, really? And she's like, these are my friends. Like, I love these men. Like, yeah. Of course I want one of them to have the seed of my child.
And then there, but it's like super complicated too, because Glenn Close did cheat on him.
That's right.
With this dead guy. So
yeah, I didn't really think about it. If there, is that a bit of a, I had mine, you can have yours moment.
I think it's a lot. I think it's all of those things, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it's like human beings are complicated. I think that's that, you know, like we're complicated, that this is that life's journey is not pure, that it's riddled with layers and
complexity.
I don't know. Yeah. Complexities and stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
There is a great scene where she's grieving the lost friend in the in the shower.
In the shower crying.
Yeah, and you get to really see Glenn Close's like serious acting chops.
Yeah, because he died there. He killed himself in that house in the bathtub.
Yes.
And you know, they dance around it a little bit, but also make a couple of jokes. She makes a joke at one point, and then it's like, what an awful thing I just said.
Thing to said, yeah.
And that's so real, because people do
I
that.
I think that's true. Like, when we grieve,
yeah,
like, we have to flip into humor sometimes just to deal.
And there's no roadmap, you know? There's no right way to handle one of your old friends, and in her case, you know, former
Someone
lover.
Someone she loved, yeah. Yeah. Gosh, now I want to watch the movie again. I've seen it more than once already.
Did Paul see this? Does he like this movie?
He did not rewatch it with me. I rewatched. He was like doing a podcast or something in his office, and I was like, "Oh, I'm going to rewatch The Big Chill." And to full disclosure, I was watching it for research purposes for the pilot I'm writing right now.
Oh, cool!
Because it's I want it to be written by Lawrence Kasdan.
It's a good move.
Somehow. But I guess like it'll be through my fingers on the keyboard somehow. Like yeah. I wanted to channel him.
That was my
wish.
Right.
That if I watched it, it would rub off onto my my creative being or something.
No, you got to do that.
Yeah. So I was watching it. And I was like a blubbering mess. Like I was like crying. I mean, and I've seen the movie.
Yeah.
But like those actors are just like, I love them so much. And yeah, he didn't watch it with me, but maybe he'll watch it. If I watch it again, maybe I can get him to revisit it. Cause he did like Body Heat. He had not seen Body Heat. And then we watched it and he did like it.
Totally different movie.
Totally different movie, but you know, still same writer, I guess. So,
well, all right, Janie, I think we did it. The Big Chill
from
1983, such a good movie.
Great movie, great soundtrack, great cast.
Yeah,
great two writers of it. Maybe I should be channeling the female half of the writing team.
Well, if you're channeling Big Chill, you're channeling both.
I'm channeling Lawrence because he had the vision for the t- tone and stuff, I guess.
And,
I don't know.
And if you're sort of okay, boomer, no thanks right now, like a lot of people, set that aside and give this movie a try if you haven't seen it. It is very subtle and it is very nuanced and there is a lot of complexity. And they don't make movies like this a lot anymore.
No. And I only get mad at boomers because they're spending all of our Social Security.
Yeah, just that's that little thing.
That's my whole thing. And they're like the biggest population that votes.
Right.
So I'm hoping that changes now. I'm being like, you know, that'll change.
Yeah.
Because some of the boomers don't vote very well.
Right. They're bad at voting.
Not the boomers I know and raised me, but, you know.
Well, that's good for you.
My personal boomers are cool.
Good. Mine are family.
Yeah. Oh, that's tough, man. So there's like, there's some political divide.
Well, I mean, my family are all conservative, but me, but they're not Trumpers though. And there's a difference.
I agree.
A huge
Do you think
difference.
They'll embrace Biden or just kind of stay home?
I don't know. And I don't ask. I don't think I want to know. I don't know. Good question.
Are they in Georgia?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So you know the deal. All right, Janie. Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate you sitting down with me. This was a fun hang. And
God, thanks for having me. Thanks for listening to Stay F Homekins.
Yeah, it's great. Stay F Homekins. You can find it is. I don't even think we said it's a podcast you do with your husband Paul F Tompkins in quarantine. It's just you two being fun and sweet and funny and goofing around and talking about TV and just
everything. Yeah,
anything that comes up. It's a lot of fun and very funny. And you should check that out. Anything else? Where can they find you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter at Janie Haddad.
Okay.
I'm on Instagram at Lebanese Looker.
Okay.
And I say, please find our podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts at
Fantastic.
Stay F Homekins.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Janie. Take care.
You too. Thanks, Chuck. Take care. Be safe.
All right, everyone. I hope you like that. I hope you are as charmed by Janie as I always am. She's so much fun and such a nice person and very funny. And it was good to have a brief internet hang and to hook up with someone on the left coast and chit chat about a very good old classic film, a movie that I think we both agreed just doesn't get made like this anymore. It would be a much, much different movie these days. Not nearly as subtle or nuanced or complex and much more obvious. So we were both grateful for this conversation to be able to talk about The Big Chill and the great Lawrence Kasdan and that amazing cast, and hope you all enjoyed it too. Go watch it if you haven't. It is on Amazon Prime right now. If you have that, you can watch it for free. So that's it for us. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, take care of yourself. Go wash your hands. Stay at home. Wear that goddamn mask. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.